Okay, I want to play a piece on Operation Paperclip. This is Annie somebody, and yet again I've forgotten the name. Annie Jacobson. So Annie Jacobson has written a book on Operation Paperclip. This is from 2014, this clip. So it's been, I'm going to play about half an hour of it. I've listened to it. And it's full of information. It's a presentation she did as part of a book tour, so she's referring to slides, but the audio is pretty full of information as well. So it's worth listening to. It's worth me playing. And I'm just going to set that up now. As I said, it's about 33, 34 minutes. I'll just let it play. So bear with me a second or two. I've got it buried under stuff. Here we go.
Sure, there are many questions. Just make your way to one of the microphones. This is the end of World War II and the American government's decision to accept high-level German scientists inside its borders, some of which had done monstrous things. This is the end of World War II.
Suddenly realized without very...
I'll just skip the first minute because it's just an intro for Annie Jacobson. So let me... back it up a little bit. I'll do from here. It's just two and a half minutes in.
Very much more explanation how much technology we in fact got from the Reich, and I wanted to know more. What I learned was that while the Horton brothers were overlooked for Paperclip, their boss was not. This is their boss. This is Colonel Siegfried Knaemeyer. He was one of the Reich's top 10 pilots, and he flew on spy missions. This photograph here is Knaemeyer about to fly over Norway to choose bombing targets. And Knaemeyer, you see, that's his Paperclip photo there. And when I learned Knaemeyer came to the United States, I wondered how you could go from having Hermann Göring as your boss, as he was. Now, keep in mind, Göring was in charge of the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe. Knaemeyer was so important to Göring that in documents he refers to him as my boy. So the question for me, in my mind, was how do you have this as your boss and then suddenly have the Pentagon as your boss? I learned that when Knaemeyer retired from the U.S. Air Force in the mid-70s, he was given the Department of Defense Distinguished Civilian Service Award. And that is the highest award that a scientist can get from the Defense Department. And I wanted to know how this could be. I tracked down one of Knaemeyer's grandchildren who courageously agreed to share the story of his grandfather with me, including a box of papers that he had in the attic. And one of the most interesting things that Dirk Knaemeyer said to me and made me know that I wanted to write this story to research and report it was he said, Annie, many of my family members say, do not speak about Siegfried's past. But he, being my age, said, you know, a Google search very quickly reveals that Knaemeyer was Göring's right-hand man. And he said he would rather know the truth about his grandfather than not know it. And so that was one example of a seed planted that I knew there is more to be learned about Operation Paperclip. I'm going to take you back briefly to the fall of 1944. This is Germany there in dark blue, and of course the Allies have landed at Normandy. They're going at Germany this way. The Soviets are coming this way. And immersed inside the army soldiers are a group of scientists led by a particle physicist named Samuel Goudsmit. And that operation was sort of the precursor to Paperclip. It was called Operation Alsace. Samuel Goudsmit and his team have one mission. That is to find out about what was known as ABC weapons, atomic, biological, and chemical. They find out very quickly that Hitler's atomic program is not what that we had feared. That was lucky for us, but as Hitler told his war and weapons minister, Albert Speer, nuclear science is Jewish science. This is what Hitler said, and therefore that atomic program had not progressed the same way that the biological and chemical weapons had. Very quickly, Samuel Goudsmit, in a small apartment in Strasbourg, France, learns about this man, Dr. Kurt Blum, the Deputy Surgeon General of the Reich. And he also learns about this man, Dr. Walter Schreiber, the Surgeon General of the Third Reich. What Gutsmitz finds and these papers that I looked at were remarkable because they're just a sort of seemingly benign correspondence between scientists. The apartment belonged to a doctor named Dr. Eugen Hagen, once a temperate man, worked in the United States on a Rockefeller Foundation scholarship. And Hagen was writing to Himmler and saying, of the 100 prisoners you sent me, a group of them died in transport. Please send more. And this is a terrifying moment for Operation Alsace because they realize that the Reich is experimenting on humans from the concentration camps to push medical science in a manner that cannot be pushed if you're experimenting on rabbits and guinea pigs. So Dr. Blum and Dr. Schreiber are now on the top of the target list for Operation Alsace, and ultimately Paperclip. There you have Hitler and Goering, and of course the third horrible triad of this group of folks who are in the target eye of the Allies is Himmler. And Himmler is overseeing a vast network of state-sponsored slavery. And it's the slaves from the concentration camps that are assembling the weapons. So you have prisoners being experimented on for some of the programs, and you have prisoners being used to build rockets and such for the other weapons programs. As we're moving across Germany, all across the Reich, the Allies are coming across hidden troves of treasure like this. This is a famous photograph of gold. But also in these caves, Allies are finding documents and they're finding weapons. And this is one example. This little innocuous-looking entrance is actually the entrance to Nordhausen, which was the underground tunnel facility where Wernher von Braun, General Dornberger, and many other scientists who would later come to America are working to build the rockets for the Reich. So you see down on the bottom photograph, those are train tracks. The rocket parts would go in, the slave laborers would build them, and out of the tunnels on those trains would come V2 rockets and body parts. This is the V2 rocket. So one of our teams was sent in. These men were sent to capture 100 rockets and to ship them back to the United States so that we could fly them here at the White Sands missile range. But this is where you really see Operation Paperclip begin, because also at the same time, you have the scientists, and you see that an intelligence officer, the program sort of begins in bits and pieces, and one intelligence officer says, we have the rockets, but how about the scientists? This is von Braun, this is Dornberger, and two others who I write about in Paperclip. What's left out of the issue is that Dornberger, you can see here, he's with Himmler. They're both wearing leather coats. I find this photograph remarkable. I was not able to get permission to publish it in my book. I'm happy to show it to you here. General Dornberger went on and became a very important part of the Paperclip program. He worked for Bell Aircraft for years. He had one of the highest clearances at the Pentagon. He was a recruiting officer for Paperclip, and nothing was ever mentioned of his past, and this photograph was certainly kept hidden for a rather long time. Arthur Rudolph, George Riquet, and Dornberger, those are all their Paperclip photographs. Part of what I write about in the book is how the U.S. military was complicit, and this is a great moral conundrum, because we were complicit in needing these scientists to be put forth as the good Germans, as the benign scientists who somehow were hiding out from the Reich. But of course, we know from the photograph with General Dornberger, that is a fiction. And for example, nearby at Nordhausen was the Buchenwald concentration camp. And when I traveled to Germany to research the book, you know, this sign really came across to me as really remarkable and something I thought about often. It says, Yadam das Zina. It's an old German proverb, and it means, does everyone get what they deserve? And I often wondered, as I was researching and reporting this question, exactly that. The scientists were taken to this castle. Ironically, this had been one of Göring's Luftwaffe headquarters. It's outside Frankfurt. And when I went there also to speak to the old-time caretaker, he had lots of stories, which I write in the book, about what it was like when the U.S. military took over and set up all the scientists that we were collecting throughout the ruins of the Reich. We set them up in this facility, and we began to interview them. These are a number of the scientists who were in, it was called Dustbin, a little humor by the Allies there. But these are some of the scientists who were kept there. One of the scientists we couldn't find at first was Dr. Ambrose. Ambrose, I think, is probably the most nefarious character that I write about in the book, and I'm going to tell you briefly why. Ambrose was Hitler's favorite chemist, and I don't say that lightly. I found a document in the National Archives that I don't believe had ever been reported before. It shows an award that Ambrose was given by Hitler of 1 million Reichsmarks. And the reason that Ambrose was given that was because he co-invented sarin gas. The A in sarin stands for Ambrose. But he also invented synthetic rubber for the Reich. And this was a very big deal to Hitler. Tanks need treads. Aircraft need tires. Hitler knew the Reich was running out of rubber. And so when Ambrose invented rubber, the Führer bestowed him with favor in the form of this giant financial reward. Ambrose was also put in charge of a slave labor factory, none other than at Auschwitz. And this is an Allied intelligence photo of the Auschwitz-Birkenau complex in June of 1944. It's a little hard to interpret to the naked eye, but because it's from so high up. But you see, there's Auschwitz up there. It's labeled. There's Birkenau. And down on the bottom, you can just barely see, it says Auschwitz III Buna. Buna is the name for synthetic rubber. And this was where Ambrose was manager. And slaves who were spared the gas chamber, some of whom I interview for the book, were sent to Buna to work. Most of them were worked to death. Of all the photographs that I found on my research and reporting, none bothered me to the degree that this one did. It was not the bodies stacked like cordwood that we all have seen and have horrified us, but rather it was this, and it's because of what that sign says. It says Company Sporting Club IG Auschwitz. And those are two of Otto Ambrose's colleagues fencing. So after a day in the laboratory, they would go for sport and fence. And as it was explained to me by the academics at the Fritz Bauer Institute, who allowed me to publish this photograph, they told me that this sporting event would take place in the afternoons well within the sight of the three large chimneys of the death camp's crematoria. That Otto Ambrose became part of Paperclip is horrifying. Dr. Bloma, captured by the Allies, begins talking. He's the first high-ranking member of the Third Reich, also close to Hitler. He wore the golden party badge, which means he had favor from the Führer. And he begins cooperating with the Allies and tells them about atrocities, mass sterilization, and gassing of Jews. There's a tug of war going on. One group of scientists is extremely interested in Dr. Blum. He's in charge of Hitler's biological weapons program. He's been working on a bubonic plague weapon. But there's a tug of war going on because here you have Dr. Leopold Alexander, who has been sent to Germany not to try to find scientists, interrogate them, find out their knowledge, and decide whether or not they should be part of Operation Paperclip, but rather to look for men, specifically science, specifically doctors, who might be tried at the Nuremberg war crimes trials. At the same time, you have Harry Armstrong, later the second Surgeon General of the Third Reich, Armstrong is interested in enhancing pilot performance in the United States. The next war will involve pilots who fly high, fast, and far. And the Reich, Harry Armstrong knows, is far advanced in pilot physiology at this point than the U.S. Army Air Forces, and he wants those German doctors. He teams up with Dr. Hubertus Strughold, known as the father of space medicine. We'll talk about Strughold a little bit later on. Strughold was the top man in Luftwaffe medicine. When I was doing an interview recently, someone said, well, could people that were this high up not have known? And the best analogy I can give you is imagine being a hedge fund manager today and trying to say that you're not interested in capitalism. If you were to rise to the top of your field in the Third Reich, you had knowledge of things and you had a commitment to an ideology that is almost impossible, in my estimation, to say that you didn't know. Nevertheless, Harry Armstrong and Hubertus Strughold create a partnership in Germany, and they hire these men. This photograph, never published before. Richard Kuhn is in the center, a very famous Nobel Prize-winning chemist, and many other scientists who would come to the United States as part of Operation Paperclip to work in Texas. But before that happened, there was a knock on the door in the institute where they were all set up to work in Germany before their passage to the United States could be arranged. And that was from, as I told you, Dr. Leopold Alexander. He wanted these three for war crimes, as he wanted Dr. Theodore Benziger. Dr. Theodore Benziger, when I read about his obituary in the New York Times, published in 1999, when Benziger was 94, the New York Times lauded his long career for the U.S. Navy as a doctor. It talked about how he invented the ear thermometer, but it left out entirely that Dr. Theodore Benziger was part of a small group of doctors that worked with Himmler. And when Himmler would show films of medical murder experiments at the Reich Air Ministry, he had Dr. Theodore Benziger do the introductions. So this is this kind of whitewashing I found astonishing. And even more troubling, when I looked deep into the Nuremberg files, I found out that Dr. Theodore Benziger was on the initial list to be tried at the doctor's trial. And yet, mysteriously, just 3 weeks before trial, he was released into custody of Harry Armstrong of the U.S. Army Air Forces, and he was on his way to the United States. Part of Dr. Alexander's role was to find witnesses, to find the few survivors of those horrific concentration camp medical experiments and put them on trial. So we had the doctor's trial. There you see Dr. Bloma in the center. He would be acquitted and he would later become part of Paperclip. And there you see Dr. Alexander with a witness who comes into the story later at the Nuremberg doctor's trial. This is one of the doctors. You know, someone once asked me, did any of the doctors know each other? And they absolutely did. Dr. Alexander, part of the reason why he was chosen to be the chief medical expert for the Nuremberg trials was that he had grown up in Vienna, and he left when the Nazis took power. So he was a fluent German speaker, and he was astonished to figure out at the doctor's trial that he was in the same medical class with Dr. Biegelbach. Carl Hollenrainer, one of the few survivors of those experiments. I tell this story in the book, but there's so many moments that I came across that are just lost to history. I couldn't believe that I had never heard of them, and they seemed to not have been written about anywhere. Carl Hollenrainer was the subject of the salt water experiments, and I won't give you the details because they're gruesome. You can read some of them in the book. But Hollenrainer was so outraged at Biegelbach, who had performed those experiments on him. He came into the Nuremberg trials with a dagger hidden in his pocket. And while he was on the witness stand, he leapt off the stand and he tried to stab a Beagle Bock. And one of the Nuremberg judges was so upset with him because he said, "We are here to show what democracy is all about," that he sent poor Karl Hollenreiter back into the prison with the Nazi doctors. Dr. Walter Schreiber, hold that thought. He was absent from the doctor's trial. He'd been captured by the Soviets. Jumping over to another program briefly and quickly, some of the men who worked for the U.S. Army really felt that this program was terrible, and they didn't want to be working with Nazi potential war criminals. But there was also a Soviet threat, and they felt that it was perhaps the lesser of two evils. Other Army officers really seemed to like these scientists with full knowledge of how complicit they had been in war crimes. And that was very disturbing. General Lukes here was one of them. There he is holding an incendiary bomb. And there he is. I found this actually in General Lukes' personal papers at the U.S. Army Heritage Institute in upstate Pennsylvania. And I'm going to speak for a second about reporting the story and how stories like this get reported. There's sort of an idea that you just file a Freedom of Information Act and magically all these documents appear. And that's, of course, not the case. I often think of myself a bit like a detective and that you have to really find your way to the story. But when I saw this photograph of General Lukes seeming to enjoy himself at a cocktail party with Hitler's chemists, I decided to track down Lukes' personal papers, which I found at the History Institute. And that's where I found out, I'm going to jump forward, I found General Lukes' diaries. And this is that incredible human element of it all where, you know, I keep a diary, maybe lots of you do, and you sort of write like things maybe you're not supposed to write. And General Lukes wrote, you know, attended a conference with Dr. Schieber, classified matters. And all along, the Department of Defense had been telling me that Schieber had never been part of Paperclip. That's Schieber. He was a SS Brigade Führer. He served on Reichsfuhrer SS Himmler's personal staff. He worked on concentration camps experiments. He was a chemist. There he is wearing the golden party badge I told you about. That means he had favor from the Führer. But the reason that Schieber was never known to be part of Paperclip was because he was later hired by the CIA, and they were able to put a different classification on his papers. So up until this point, Schieber's participation in this program was not known. His courageous family members in Germany also gave me some very interesting information, which I report in the book. But just to show you how high up Schieber was and why it was necessary to keep him a very big secret, there he is. I couldn't get permission to publish this photograph. I'm happy to show it to you here. There he is shaking hands with Hitler in the forest. But ultimately, I was able, through that sort of detective work and finding out about Dr. Schieber's participation in Paperclip, and I was able to get that list, and there it is. That's the official list of all the high-ranking chemical weapons experts on Hitler's roster who ended up working as part of Paperclip. And just a fascinating photograph of Schieber that his family shared with me, and that's when he was working for the CIA. So people often ask, how could this have happened? And this is why. You know, there was a very real threat, and that was the Soviet Union. And the threat was thermonuclear war. Very quickly, the Cold War heated up. And all of those criminals that we had sent to prison, well, we needed Germany as an ally. And so John McCloy, U.S. High Commissioner, he left his position as president of the World Bank and agreed to go to Germany to serve as High Commissioner, and he released the majority of those convicted Nazi war criminals. They had been in Landsberg Prison. Those are the unmarked graves of the 486 who had been hung, but he released a lot of them, including Ambrose. I found this picture to be incredibly disturbing. That's Ambrose. I told you, the A for Ambrose and sarin gas, Hitler's favorite chemist. He was managing the Auschwitz III Buna factory. He was actually tried at Nuremberg. He was convicted of mass murder and slavery. There he is in a Nuremberg photograph, laughing with his lawyers. Perhaps he had foresight and knew that he would be given clemency by U.S. High Commissioner John McCloy, released, and he would become later on contract with the U.S. Department of Energy. Some of the doctors were such hot potatoes, that was the actual term that they used, if someone couldn't come to the United States. And so they were sent to this facility outside Frankfurt. It was a black site. I sort of think of it as the original post-war black site. And that is where we worked on enhanced interrogation techniques with Soviet bloc prisoners. Ultimately, this program would become known as the infamous MK Ultra program. But it began here much earlier than thought. And lo and behold, who were the two physicians at Camp King? Dr. Schreiber, released from the Russians. Many thought he was a Soviet mole. And Dr. Kurt Blomma. But the reason that Blomma got the position was because Schreiber came to the United States. And this was one of the most horrifying moments to research and report, was that Dr. Schreiber, whose specialty was actually lethal phenol injections, it was a quick way to get rid of someone at a concentration camp. He oversaw those experiments. We knew it. We couldn't prosecute him at Nuremberg because he was in the Soviet Union, and he actually was a witness for the Soviet Union at the Nuremberg trials. But now he was on the American team, and he was sent to America, to this place, the U.S. Air Force School of Aviation Medicine at Randolph Field. Harry Armstrong, whose photograph I showed you, he had set this place up. This would become the bastion of U.S. aerospace medicine, ultimately. And when Dr. Schreiber, the former Surgeon General of the Third Reich, arrived in the United States, and here's where circumstance plays into the story. I really love when fate and circumstance work in a very interesting way that perhaps justice cannot. Schreiber, there's a small article in an Air Force medical journal about him, and it just describes him as an ex-Soviet prisoner. This is the former Surgeon General of the Third Reich. That's what it says about him, a little hubris that he had agreed to or wanted to have this article there. And who happened to read that journal at that exact time, that moment in time in 1951, but Dr. Leopold Alexander, the chief war crimes prosecutor from the doctor's trial. And he was outraged, and he called up Harry Armstrong, who is now the Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force, and says, this man is a Nazi war criminal, and there must be some mistake. But there is no mistake. Schreiber is working among these guys, 34 of whom are at Randolph Field working on U.S. Space medicine, and they don't want to have to call attention to this, and they do not want to have to let go of Dr. Schreiber. And so there's a dramatic tug of war behind the scenes. Dr. Alexander decides to go to the press. He calls up a reporter from the Boston Globe and says that Schreiber's in the country. But also, as fate and circumstance would have it, at this exact time, I showed you this photograph earlier. This is a witness from the Ravensbrück concentration camp who was part of the medical experiments that Schreiber was part of. She just so happened to be coming to the United States at this time. Dr. Alexander and a colleague in Boston are giving pro bono medical treatment to anyone who is a victim and a survivor of the Nazi concentration camp medical experiments. She's in the United States at this exact time. Just to give you an idea, that's what her leg looked like from some of the experiments. Dr. Alexander and Alexander Hardy, who was assistant prosecutor, together wrote to President Truman and said, Dr. Schreiber must be expelled. And a little bit of justice, this was the article in the New York Times as he left for Argentina. And it says, Nazi physician leaving. So in the end, paperclip, those 1,600 scientists had different trajectories in their life. I write about what their lives were like in my book, but of course the most famous among them was Wernher von Braun. And Arthur Rudolph, who had been in charge of the underground weapons facility at Nordhausen, where 30,000 slave laborers died building the V-2 rockets. He was one of the few German scientists who was investigated by the Department of Justice, not until 1983, but investigated nonetheless. And Rudolph was given a choice. He could stay here and stand trial for war crimes, or he could go back to Germany, and he chose to go to Germany. Kurt Davis, the first director of the JFK Space Center, toward the end of my research, I was learning about Davis. He wore the SS uniform to work. He also, in documents that I read through thoroughly, turned over a colleague to the Gestapo who had for making anti-Hitler remarks. And there's this incredible moment in the early part of Paperclip where one group of American intelligence officers who are recruiting for Paperclip find Davis's information out, and they notify the Joint Chiefs who and the group working at the Pentagon to get the different individual scientists here, and they say Davis cannot be brought to the United States. He deliberately and viciously turned over a colleague to the Gestapo who went to prison. But the Joint Chiefs say, we need him, and he comes. To this day, the National Space Club gives out the Dr. Kurt Davis Award. And there he is. When I asked the director of that award what he says when a journalist asks him, why do you continue to give out an award to a known Nazi? He said that no one had ever asked him that question before. I think ultimately Einstein had it right. Einstein left Germany as soon as the Nazis took power. And his quote was that the reason he had left was because science and justice were now in the hands of a raw and rabid mob of Nazi militia. There he is getting his U.S. citizenship. The majority of the 1,600 Operation Paperclip scientists who came here were given that coveted U.S. citizenship. So I leave you with the last thought, which is Yadem Das Zaina, that sign over the Buchenwald Gate. We know from a document that Wernher von Braun himself would go to the Buchenwald camp and handpick slave laborers to work on the rockets. So is that really true? Does everyone get what he deserves? I sought out that answer from all the different individuals that I interviewed, but the best answer that I got came from now 91-year-old Gerhard Machowski. And as a teenager, he was spared the gas chamber at Auschwitz because he could work. He became a slave laborer at Buna, at that factory that Otto Ambrose ran. And I said, Gerhard, you know, is it true and what lasts? And he smiled and he pulled back the sleeve of his arm and he showed me that blue ink Auschwitz tattoo. And he said, this is what matters. This lasts. And it's a record of the truth. I want to thank you all for coming tonight and I welcome your questions.
Okay, that was Anna Jacobson talking about Operation Paperclip. I'm probably going to buy the book and turn it into a mind map at some point. I haven't done that so far, but that's on my list of things to do. And hopefully anybody who's been listening to that will do some investigation. Look into Operation Paperclip, look into MKUltra, see what the connections are, see what all of those projects from the late 40s, early 50s, late 50s, early 60s onwards, see how they all link up. Turn them into a mind map if you can. turn them into a diagram so that it makes sense to you. That's the way that I do it. And that way I remember more of it. If I've turned it into a mind map, then it makes more sense to me as a mind map. But I'll leave you with that, because it's 35 minutes, so it's heavy stuff to get through. But it's worth having it on record. And this way I'll not lose it. I'll remember that it's on here.